Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure. Thank you, Steve, for your help. See you next week. Same time, same place, same station. Have a great, great day. Thank you. Bye now.
Heaven is under the earth. I know you don't know what life is really worth. It's an all that glitter is gold. After story had never been told. So now you see the light. Hey, stand up for your right. Come on,
get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up.
And good morning. It is 9 o'clock here on your Thursday. You are listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up in a half hour, we've got Fight the Empire on the way with our host, Per Fogering, who connects history with the latest in world events. We've also got Air Cascadia at 10 o'clock this morning. That's Chris Andre hosting with interviews, cutting-edge news, and her views. At 10:15, it'll be Flashpoints, investigative news journalism with host Dennis Bernstein. On today's show, we'll hear the first installment of a 15-part special series on the history and future of public education in the United States. At 11 o'clock on Between the Covers, host Gene Bradley will be speaking with David Truer about his life, his work, and his new novel, Prudence, a story of love, loss, identity, and desire in World War II era America. And then at 11:30, it's Words and Pictures. Today, host SW Concert explores the worlds of comics and graphic novels in Portland and beyond. Stick around, though. Up next, we've got Teresa Mitchell hosting Press Watch with all the news you're not supposed to know. Stick around. That's next on KBOO.
KBOO Community Radio invites you to our springtime open house and live in-studio performance of Mama C, Saturday, March 21st, from 1 to 5 p.m. Welcome, welcome. Tour the KBOO studios and meet your community. Share refreshments and talk with other listeners, program hosts, volunteers, and KBOO staff. See how our communities intersect and work together to create this amazing community radio station. We'll also have a live performance by Mama C, an accomplished musician, poet, and MC, as well as a former Black Panther and political refugee who fled the U.S. in early 1970s for Tanzania. Again, that's Saturday, March 21st, from 1 to 5 p.m., an open house and live performance by Mama C at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, your community radio station, KBOO Portland. We look forward to seeing you.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
Thank you.
Quick update for Press Watch fans. Teresa Mitchell is on the way. Stuck in that Portland traffic.
Good morning. It's 9:06 a.m. and this is KBOO Portland. So sorry getting in a little late today. But I want to start with some headlines. Russia will deploy Tupolev nuclear-capable bomber jets to Crimea in a snap drill. That's according to a defense ministry source on Tuesday, as reported in DefenseNews.com. The peninsula marks a year since its annexation by Moscow. The source told Russian news agencies, as a part of a snap check of combat readiness of armed forces, Tupolev 22 M3 strategic missile carriers will be deployed to Crimea. And departing from the article, those Tupolev 22s are not the Tupolev 94s I've been yelling about for months now. These are supersonic bombers. Returning to the article from Defense News, the source said the deployment of the long-range bombers was part of a snap check ordered by President Vladimir Putin on Monday of the combat readiness of more than 40,000 troops nationwide in a major show of strength and tensions with the West over Ukraine. Russia said last year it wanted the bombers to be based back in the strategically important Black Sea Peninsula, which hosts a major naval base. By 2016, under the USSR, the bombers were based in Crimea, supporting the Navy, but Russia withdrew its planes after the fall of the USSR and after Ukraine gained independence. The European Union warned Monday of the growing militarization of Crimea as it condemned Moscow's illegal annexation of the region from Ukraine. In a documentary aired Sunday, Putin said he was ready to put the country's nuclear forces on alert as he sought to take Crimea last year. Also from Defense News, in the Black Sea, NATO ships, like the U.S. destroyer Donald Cook, have been buzzed by Russian fighters. Russian Tupolev 95 bear bombers have reportedly been tracked near Canada, conducting missile strike drills within range of targets in the United States, and Russian airplanes have been tracked as close as 50 miles from the California coast, the closest they've come since the end of the Cold War. Quoting Lieutenant General John Nicholson, "My concern about those kinds of activities is there can be a miscalculation or a mistake that could lead to a confrontation. When you look at the history of warfare, it's replete with examples where a miscalculation or a mistake can spin into war," end quote. And speaking for myself, I certainly think that the same thing could be said of the troops and tanks that the U.S. is putting all around Russia at the moment. But more on that in just a moment. Returning to the article from Defense News, they wouldn't dare call it war news, would they? The tensions amid this Russian aggression has pushed a region that took a backseat to the conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan and saw a drawdown of 10,000 soldiers, including two heavy brigade combat teams, back into the spotlight. The Army is dialing up its missions in the regions with plans to, and they're talking about the U.S. Army, continue three-month troop deployments of about 800 soldiers with the likely addition of aviation rotations. The Army is also contributing soldiers to a NATO response force of expected 4,000 to 5,000 troops, added a brigade's worth of tanks and Bradley fighting vehicles by the end of this year. All of these efforts by the U.S. Army in Europe are part of what Lieutenant General Frederick Ben Hodges, the commanding general of U.S. Army Europe, has dubbed Strong Europe. And quoting that man, Strong Europe is meant to convey the framework of what U.S. Army Europe as a forward station force is able to provide on behalf of the Army to European Command and NATO. And that's the end of that quote. Senior military leaders, including NATO's top military officer, Air Force General Philip Breedlove, are calling for a halt to the U.S. withdrawal from Europe. U.S. lawmakers are calling for a Defense Department to stop retiring F-15 aircraft in Europe and stop the removal of dual-capable aircraft from the European area of operations. The Navy has sent ships on presence missions to the Baltic and the Black Seas. A little bit more on this war buildup by the United States versus Russia. A nuclear standoff. Returning to the article, NATO in December certified land command based in Izmir, Turkey, as the headquarters for a major joint operation if needed to command a large-scale multi-core employment of ground forces. The Army has rotated troops with their tanks and Bradleys to train with militaries in Poland and the Baltic states for the last 9 months. These rotations, part of a series of exercises under Operation Atlantic Resolve, will continue into 2016 with soldiers from the 2nd Cavalry Regiment, followed by troops from the 1st Brigade Combat Team, 3rd Infantry Division. So the march towards the standoff of the world's remaining major nuclear power continues. This is Press Watch. I'm Teresa Mitchell. News you're not supposed to know. This is KBOO Portland. I want to talk about climate change. Seems to me to be a confluence of effects. The atmosphere and the ocean retain more heat from CO2. You may have heard that the Pacific Ocean off the coast is up to 7 degrees warmer. Long-term patterns change. Heat waves make trees die. Forests dry out. Texas has dried out. Forests burn. Soot appears on glaciers. From the burning forest, glaciers melt due to the soot-altered albedo. Thermohaline circulation changes in the ocean. Drought results. More forests burn. The permafrost tundra melts. Methane is released from the tundra. Atmosphere heats up from tundra methane. Clathrates are released from heated submarine coastal areas. And the atmosphere heats further from clathrate methane. Droughts appear as a result. Forests burn in droughts. Human populations are economically stressed from natural disasters like forest fires and from billionaireism. Humans migrate. CO2 is released from migrations and from insane commutes. As wealth is pooled and workers' housing is excluded from common work areas, Brazil is a perfect example of that. The political will for climate change is sapped as billionaires suck wealth out of communities and make everyone desperate for short-term fixes. Fracking gets approved. Methane is released from fracking big time. Cheap fracking oil increases CO2 and discourages solar and wind investment. Jobs are shipped overseas so that products are shipped overseas. People don't have money to buy solar panels, CO2 increases, poverty increases, ice cap melts, climate conferences appear, generate propaganda, disappear. Cyclones obliterate nations. The rich speak of geoengineering. You may have heard about this on Democracy Now! Recently, quoting Amy Goodman, she was asking Bill McKibben about another climate crisis closer to home. On Thursday, she said, a NASA scientist wrote an op-ed in the Los Angeles Times, headlined, California has about 1 year of water left. Will you ration now? And she said, Jay Famiglietti, who authored the piece, is a senior water scientist at the NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratory, Caltech, and is a professor of Earth System Science at the University of California, Irvine. He wrote, quote, the simple fact is that California is running out of water, and the problem started before our current drought. NASA data reveal that total water storage in California has been in a steady decline since at least 2002 when satellite-based monitoring began. Although groundwater depletion has been going on since the early 20th century, right now the state has only about 1 year water supply left in its reservoirs, and our strategic backup supply groundwater is rapidly disappearing. And then she asked Bill McKibben, and he said, hey, it's up and down the west coast of the United States. Yesterday, Washington State declared drought emergency over large regions. The snowpack in the Olympic Mountains is about 8% of normal. The snowpack up in the Sierra Nevada, which has to water pretty much all of California, is 20 or 25% of normal. We're in the fourth year of a drought, and the scientific papers published in the last couple of weeks said that California can really start expecting in our new climate regime that drought will be the new normal. And McKibben said last year the satellites indicated that California had lost about 63 trillion gallons of groundwater, to evaporation. That took so much weight off the crust that the Sierra Nevada mountains jumped a half inch. And he said, look, there's no way you can have civilizations of the kind that we built in California without water. And there's less and less of it all the time. And Bill McKibben, in that interview on Democracy Now!, went on to say that in Sao Paulo, people are drilling through the concrete in their basements looking for groundwater. And he said there have been parts of the city that have been undergoing severe water rationing. This is what happens when you raise the temperature of the earth. There is no surprise in it, but it is horrifying to see it play out, end quote. This from Reuters. Oregon Governor Kate Brown declared a drought emergency on Tuesday in two rural Oregon counties, with more expected in coming weeks as the state suffers abnormally low snowpack levels. The declarations in Oregon come as much of the U.S. West grapples with severe drought conditions. Last week, Washington State Governor Jay Inslee declared a drought emergency. Skipping ahead, Brown declared a drought emergency in Mellor and Lake counties in southeastern Oregon after dry conditions, low snowpack, and lack of precipitation prompted county officials to request the declaration. The snowpack levels across the state for March are between 6 and 38% of normal. That's a quote from Raquel Rancier, Senior Policy Coordinator for the state's Water Resources Department. In Lake County, a small rural area in the high desert region that is home to cattle ranches and natural resources, the snowpack is 17% of normal. And you may have heard that lucky us in western Oregon, it's likely to snow in the mountains today. This from grist.org. Remember when we found out last year that the West Antarctic ice sheet had started to collapse, that the collapse more or less can't be stopped, and that it will eventually result, in 10 to 15 feet of sea level rise. Now we have some more news, bad news of that caliber. An enormous glacier, one on the other side of the continent from the Ailing ice sheet, is doing pretty much the same thing researchers have discovered. Chris Mooney reports for the Washington Post. The findings about East Antarctica emerged from a new paper just out in Nature Geoscience by an international team of scientists representing the United States, Britain, France, and Australia. They flew a number of research flights over the Totten Glacier of East Antarctica, the fastest thinning sector of the world's largest ice sheet, and took a variety of measurements to try to figure out the reasons behind its retreat. And the news wasn't good. It appears that Totten II is losing ice because warm ocean water is getting underneath it. The floating ice shelf of the Totten Glacier covers an area of 90 miles by 22 miles. It is losing an amount of ice equivalent to 100 times the volume of Sydney Harbor every year, according to the Australian Antarctic Division. That's alarming because the glacier holds back a much more vast catchment of ice that, were its vulnerable parts to flow into the ocean, would produce a sea level rise of more than 11 feet, which is comparable to the impact from a loss of the West Antarctic ice sheet. And that's a conservative lower limit, according to lead study author Jameen Greenbaum, a PhD candidate at the University of Texas at Austin. So add them together, we're talking 20 feet of sea level rise. You're listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. This is the news you're not supposed to know. I got a letter, as many of you did, in the email from Peace and Justice Works, Portland Cop Watch, from Dan Handelman and his team, and pointed out that there's an article in Nation Magazine which outlines ways in which the Portland police are not making changes even under the scrutiny of the Department of Justice. If you follow the link to the online version, it also links out to a bunch of articles he wrote, including one that ran in The Nation in 2011 that talked about James Chassie, Aaron Campbell, and Keaton Otis. And the article, which is by Zoe Carpenter, begins like this. It was just after midnight on a September Sunday when several police officers responding to reports of property damage approached a small group of young black men walking down a street in North Portland, Oregon. Among them was 16-year-old Ty Garula, a football player at Roosevelt High School, and his older brother Giovanni. Officers ordered Ty to stop. He kept walking. Within minutes, Ty would be tackled by several officers, forced to the ground, tased, and handcuffed. Later, despite a judge's ruling that the initial stop was illegal He'd face charges of resisting arrest, assaulting a public safety officer, and attempted strangulation. Giovanni would face similar, though less serious, charges. The Portland Police Bureau worked quickly to defend their officers, releasing a statement that explained that the Guerrilla Brothers were very hostile and that Ty demonstrated, quote, active aggression, including his choking the female officer, end quote. And take a breath there, and when I'm reading this sort of thing, I have to calm down. I have to admit to you that I've also been tackled by Portland police, also unjustly. I was charged with resisting. They tried to put me down for 10 years. They failed. So I get a little emotional reading this sort of thing. And I am, of course, sympathetic to people who have been tackled by police officers and Portland police officers for no good reason. And again and again, we see the theme that if there is the least resistance to an unjust and aggressive action by the police, they feel justified to take any action up to and including murder. And one could argue that it is some of the cops who do that, but it is all of the cops who stand behind it. So if you're a cop or know a cop and you find that offensive, well, I'm just trying to tell the truth. Returning to the article, cell phone videos captured a different scene. Ty, sleight of body, standing still between two officers. "Can I ask you a question?" Giovanni can be heard saying. "What did my little brother do? He don't do nothing. He plays football for Roosevelt. Come on now. He don't drink. He don't smoke," end quote. Suddenly, the officers pull Ty towards the ground. His white hat falls off. He reaches for it through the scrum. Officers bark orders and bystanders shout, "Stop pulling his hair. Why are you punching him? That's illegal. What's the problem that he caused?" And an expletive. When they tase him, Ty begins to gasp, his high-pitched keening overlaid by the hoarser panic protest coming from his older brother. Less than a month earlier, the Portland Police Bureau had reached a groundbreaking agreement with the Department of Justice to settle a case stemming from repeated incidences of police violence. It was a schizophrenic who was beaten to death by officers. And departing from the text, they're referring to James Chassie. The suicidal young black man who was shot in the back after concerned relatives called the police. Another young man in a mental health crisis who was shot to death after cops pulled him over for driving like a gangster. The deal, as described by the Department of Justice, will put in place innovative new mechanisms for community oversight, and it requires reforms to training and use of force guidelines. The Bureau's treatment of mentally ill people was the focus of the federal inquiry. The Department of Justice did also acknowledge the often tense relationship between the Portland Police Bureau and the African American community, and that some Portlanders believe city cops are out to protect the white folk and police the black folk. But the feds didn't dig for the roots of that tension. Portland is roughly 6% African American, while just over 3% of the police force is. About 14% of the people pulled over in traffic stops are African American, as are a quarter of people shot at by police. And before I continue with that, speaking as a white person, I know the white person script, and the white person script just went off in thousands of people listening to KBOO Portland right now. And let's catch that script, all right? And the script went, well, if they didn't act like... And it goes on from there. And you know what it is, my fellow white people. And I don't need to go there because we've heard so many people say it, and so many people think it, and a lot of people think it's true. Well, it isn't. It's been statistically, carefully proven not to be true. White people... more likely to carry drugs. White people more likely to carry drugs. White people more likely to carry drugs. Less likely to be stopped. Less likely to be charged. More likely to have a lawyer. And that's how it goes. And yeah, this is racism. The situation with the police is racism. And it's white supremacy. And that is the dangerous racism right now. And you can say, oh, well, people are racist, and you can say all kinds of things. We need to deal with white supremacy. I love white people. I love white people. I hate white supremacy. I'm here to destroy white supremacy. And I've been talking about imperialism. I've been talking about nuclear war. I've been talking about the destruction of the planet as long As white people hang on to white supremacy and make excuses for it, we powerful white people, will not be able to work in tandem with all the other people here in this nation, on this planet, because we'll be divided, and we are the ones who are dividing, because we are benefiting every day. Every time you want a job, every time you want to roll past a cop 3 miles over the speed limit, you're benefiting. And it just goes on and on. But returning to the article, beneath the gloss of white Portland's self-conscious progressivism are grievances related to this skewed use of force, to the rapid gentrification of historically black neighborhoods, to the decline of black-owned businesses and public schools in those areas, and a deep history of state-sanctioned racism. A senior at De La Salle North Catholic High School put it in a forum on racial profiling in early March. "I live north of Portlandia, the one you know nothing about," end quote. Portland's reform efforts come in the context of a national outcry against police violence and its disproportionate impact on people of color, as well as new eagerness within the Department of Justice to force changes to local law enforcement. The debate about how best to reform the police and whether police reform is even the right thing to focus on is spreading and intensifying. Portland's homogeneity and its reputation for liberalism and livability make the city's policing problems appear less acute than in, say, Ferguson, Missouri. But it's worth asking why a city that by some measures is best equipped politically to build a better policing model hasn't been able to do so. The Gorilla case demonstrated that even with the settlement agreement on paper, we still have a long road ahead on implementation. Those last words being a quote of Reverend Leroy Haynes, Jr., chair of Albina Ministerial Alliance Coalition for Justice and Police Reform, which was instrumental in the development of the settlement. Haynes views that agreement as a foundation for beginning to really slowly transform the Portland Police Bureau, but he told the interviewer, "It's no panacea," quoting, "I think the Department of Justice chose the easier route at the time, but you can't transform the Bureau without transforming its impact on communities of color," end quote. This is an article in The Nation about Portland getting national attention for our failure to stop this racial phenomenon, this racial animus, this white supremacy that comes out and is expressed, I want to say, through the Portland police. But the Portland police are doing what they correctly perceive they are expected to do. So there's only so much blame I want to put on the police. The real blame is all people who buy in. All white people who benefit from white supremacy and won't admit it, and who look the other way when the sort of aggression goes down. And when you're honest about what really happens, then a lot of things become more clear. Like the fact that the United States is the monster against the world right now. And that we kill 28 people for every so-called terrorist that we blow up with a drone strike. And those drones are made here in the United States. And they were engineered here in the United States. They're transported. And they're piloted here in the United States. And there isn't any way to say that any of us is innocent. Because I pay taxes. You pay taxes. People who try not to pay federal taxes pay taxes. We're all on this Titanic. And we're just going to have to rush the pilot's room. Just got a notice that not clear whether Pear is going to make it in this morning. I certainly hope that he does, but that opens up the phone lines, and I guess it's that kind of morning because I was running late this morning as well, and I'd like to thank Rock for improvising so well. I was pleased when you started running the press watch theme. I thought, oh, he believes, he trusts.
If we play it, it'll make
man.
It so.
Yes.
That's right.
But no, I wasn't here yet. I am so sorry. So that means that you can call in, and we do have a great deal to talk about. Earlier, I was talking about imperialism, and I was talking about climate change, and you're welcome to call in about that. Here's the number to call in with your comments or questions. I would like to encourage new callers because of the dynamics, because of the sound of my voice. I sound male. I'm actually not. I'm a hermaphroditic, transgendered woman. And when I'm doing my job in public, I do my best to talk like this. And I'm not very good with a female voice, but it helps me pass a little bit better. But I don't use that on the air because, well, it's complex. It's psychologically complex. But one of the reasons that I don't do it is that for whatever reason, people listen to male voices. I think the main reason is just that I did it in this voice for so long, and so I feel like I would be sort of pulling a trick using a different voice. I don't know. I may change that someday. That's the way it goes. I just want to be open about transgenderism because there's so much that needs to be said about that. The number to call, 503-231-8187. 503-231-8187. By the way, before I take a call, I mentioned transgenderism, and right now, for trans women, there is a special problem that we have right now because we're being focused on by the Christian right, and the Christian right would like to eliminate the equality that has been developing for us, mostly, I would say, as a result of Hollywood, as a result of shows like, I think it's called Transparent on Amazon. And things are changing, and people are becoming aware that trans women are using public facilities. It always gets down to the bathroom. And one of the things that the Christian right has been doing has been using groups like, I think it's Pacific Justice Institute, I think.